It's the 24th of June, 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. If phones can be banned from recording gigs, will they also be able to ban the twats who spill their drinks on you? If atheists are not allowed to deny the existence of God on buses, are Jews allowed to use their Oyster cards? Why do disabled people have it so easy? Why do so few young men donate bone marrow? Is it because they keep on saying they'll do it tomorrow? And how can scientists get kids interested in science without declaring that Justin Bieber is in fact an unpleasant disease? But first, if Marcus Brigstocke has never seen Star Wars, has he never seen God either? A new book has hit the shelves this week in which an atheist explains why he wants to believe in God. And that atheist is comedian Marcus Brigstocke. Here's Liz Luckendorf with more.
Marcus Brigstocke, for those of you who might not know him or his work, is a comedian and satirist. He's worked extensively in radio and television, and also a spot or two of musical theater. However, he's recently turned his 2009 tour, God Caller, into a book of the same name. For those of you who may have missed the stand-up tour, God Caller is Brigstocke's personal reflection on his want for a god, despite being an atheist. It's a very funny read, but it also stops and makes you think between the many jokes. It certainly made me a bit uncomfortable in places, and as a comfortable atheist, it's generally not a place I like being. However, he did win me around at the end, and so I challenge you to pick up the book, get a bit angry around the middle, but feel good at the end. It is hysterically funny, so expect some odd looks when you break out into laughter on public transport. Marcus kindly sat down with us and chatted about all things godly and not so godly.
So we're here with Marcus Brigstocke, author of God Caller, who you may also know from telly and radio. You've done loads. You've done I've Never Seen Star Wars, The Nail Show, The Late Edition, which I loved when it was on.
Thank you.
Definitely think it's the closest we've got to a British Daily Show so far.
Which... make sure that was heard, yeah. And is broadcast. Listen up, folks. That's what we were going for.
You're here today to talk about God Caller, which is a new book in which you explain how, whilst you don't believe in God, you want to.
I wish I could. Wouldn't it be excellent, rationalists?
Well, the first thing that kind of struck me is when I got to the end of it is a lot of people try to write personal biographies, but even though this wasn't a biography, it seemed much more personal than some of those. Was it kind of scary doing that show and then writing the book?
It was really scary. I think that if you're going to talk about religion and various forms of faith and beliefs that are held close to people's hearts, that you need to tread carefully somewhat. And for me, the trade-off was that it felt very important to be honest about why any of this matters to me. Why is it important? I mean, anyone could talk about religion and it's fine, but why did it matter to me personally? And so I felt it was very important to be honest. The end of the book that you were just referring to is the bit that concerns my friend James, who died, and really it was his death that made me question the atheism that I had, still have, but really threw it into quite a weird place where I found myself needing comforts that weren't easily found. And I want him to still be somewhere. I want James to know that I'm here now and go, you're almost certainly going to come across, but these people might be cleverer than you. And, you know, to watch all these sorts of things, you know. So it was important to be personal in this particular book, but not for a second to entertain the idea of doing an autobiography until I've led an altogether more interesting life.
Going into the show, and then also, I guess, it could have happened during writing the book, but did you think there'd be any kind of change in your thought? I know at the beginning you say you don't hope to kind of change to think I have the answers. But did you think it would change you at all, or did you just kind of go in as kind of a cathartic experience?
No, it'd be dishonest to say that I thought that the process might eventually lead me to a place where I went, hallelujah. I never thought that would take place. And I knew that wouldn't happen. However, going into it as a subject has made me question on a deeper level what atheism is for me, why I am an atheist, and whether that's important or whether it's just a circumstance of sort of who I am. I talk about it, about settling for the delusion. If you assume that, you know, that belief in an Abrahamic God is a delusion, as Professor Dawkins tells us, praise be upon him, then I just see the value of the delusion, and you know, I'd choose it if I could. I just can't. I'm not brilliant at that sort of delusion.
I found it interesting when you said there's a point where you said it was really hard to get through Dawkins, it was a really hard read. But then you list off these other books, you know, God Not Great and A.C. Grayling, but also the Bible, you read the Bible.
And the Torah and the Quran.
I figured those would be really hard.
Yeah, they are. But to be perfectly honest, they are, because they're not scientific or logical, you can, and I did, skim read those. I read the bits that... You could, if you read Genesis all the way through, you can get a pretty solid idea of the God that is being discussed. You know, after God murdered everybody. I didn't read that section there. Although that's, well, you'll have seen from the book, that's a subject that fascinates me. The number of nursery schools that are called the Noah's Ark Nursery. And isn't it lovely, because God was so sweet and he saved those people and he put them on the boat. Can you imagine the black, fetid soil afterwards? The corpses, the rotting corpses of animals and human beings, and the detritus of communities wiped out by a flood on that scale.
You mentioned as well, there's that bit when your son says, oh, you have to believe in God, because otherwise... Oh, yes. Is that kind of the rationale behind that? And did you ever find out where he learned that?
Well, my son said to me, we went to a christening, and it was really awkward the way we had to leave the christening. It all turned quite bad and we had to rush out. My son and I were cycling past the school and he said, oh, there's that church with the funny people in, which I really liked. I thought that was a lovely thing. And then I thought, well, now's a good moment. He was six at the time. And I said, yes, it was strange, wasn't it? And he said, why? And I said, well, because Daddy doesn't believe in God. And he said, you have to believe in God, Dad, or he'll send another flood like he did to Noah. And I was horrified to think that my beautiful six-year-old boy, who's so clever and so funny, that he would think that was the case. And I was so shocked by it. And as to where he got it from, I mean, it's a story, and the way that it's constructed is very brilliant. I mean, you know, it's a really great story. It's terrific. And you know how good it is, because for however many thousands of years now, a couple of thousand years, people have only talked about the survivors. It's a really good story. And as a six-year-old, he was, you know, it caught his imagination. Now that we've talked about it a little further, he thinks that the God that did that is one that he doesn't like or recognise, and thinks is barbaric.
What kind of responses did you have from the show about, from religious people about?
Good, really good, and interesting and humbling too. There's a funny thing that happens as a comedian when you finish a show. You'll often go to the same loo as people who've just seen the show, and you hold your penis, and then people talk to you while your penis is out. And it's a very difficult thing to know. You sort of want to say, shall I put my penis away before we continue this discussion, or shall we just start now? Anyway, I was having a pee, and a man came up alongside me, and he also held his penis and weed, and said, oh, I really enjoyed your show. And I thought, good, please let this wee end so that I can, you know, either get away or find a way through this discussion. And he said to me, he said, I just wanted to tell you that Jesus is waiting for you whenever you're ready for him. At which point the little switch inside me clicked and I went, right, here we go then. Right, we're off to the races. And then I thought, no, shut your mouth. This bloke just paid to listen to you and had the good grace to stay for the duration of your show, enjoyed it, and wanted to share with you something that had worked for him. Have the grace to say thank you very much, wash your hands, shake his, and leave. And it was a really... I'm glad it happened really early on, because there was no... He'd already listened to me. I wasn't going to pay to listen to him for an hour, you know, for lots of reasons, but... he still had his penis out, for one, but that was... It was a really interesting, simple, humbling thing, just... You know, I've written a whole book and a whole show that lots of people have seen, and lots of people have read the book, and actually sometimes they have things they want to say and I need to just listen to them and be offended if I want to. It's fine. That's fine.
Where can people buy the book? Have you got anything else?
Oh, yes. Work? Well, yeah, look, yes, they can buy the book from... before the internet, there were places where people used to gather and they're full of sort of paper. It's basically a fire trap. Mm. And they were called bookshops. And I think that the actual book, the papery, the leafy bugger, is available in there. You can get it on Kindle. You can have it read to you if you're lazy. By me, or you can get someone else to buy it and get them to read it to you. It's available in the sorts of places where you might hope to find books and literature.
Marcus Brigstock, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
If you'd like to get a copy of Marcus's new book, you can order it from your favourite online retailer, follow the links on the Poddelusion website, or go into those fire traps known as bookstores. On the Poddelusion website, you can also find the full-length interview with Marcus Brigstock as well. This has been Liz Lustendorf for The Pod Delusion.
Now, if you've been to a gig in the last 10 years, you can't have failed to notice the hundreds of people filming it with their mobile phones. It makes perfect sense, really. After all, later on you'll be able to look back on the grainy footage and watch a white shimmer of light in the centre of a black screen wobble about a bit, whilst a horrible distorted noise pops the speakers on your computer. And you can remember what a great time you had filming it. It turns out, though, that the man is not happy about people recording these things and has developed a worrying new technology to prevent it from happening. Here's Sean Ellis with more.
The smartphone makers have a problem. Smartphones are portable, ubiquitous, and have great video and audio built in. So far, this doesn't sound like a problem, more like an advert. The problem is that the big content industry doesn't want you to use your phone to record concerts. And to be fair, a lot of small bands don't want you to do that either. This sounds reasonable. It's up to them what restrictions they place on their events, and if CD or DVD sales afterwards make money, then it's reasonable to want to protect that stream of revenue. The trouble is, it's virtually impossible to keep smartphones out of live events. Often, it's the only form of communication that people have, which makes confiscation problematic. They're expensive, so people may not trust your bouncers with their hard-earned 400 quid shiny geek toy. So what can you do? One smartphone maker, and I don't want to single out who, because it really could have been anybody, the technology's everywhere. Anyway, one smartphone maker recently filed a patent which seems to address this problem. The camera on the phone is sensitive to infrared, so it's possible to communicate with it using invisible infrared signals without mucking up anybody's viewing experience. If you set up flashing infrared emitters on stage, which broadcast a Morse code-like signal, and the camera is set up to detect that signal and shut down, we have instant control of live events. Here's a news report from 20 minutes into the future, when this is widely available.
So, Iggy, great gig. How's LiveGuard working for you?
Yeah, well, there were these few geezers down by the mosh pit trying to record, but you could see they were getting nowhere. CD sales are up quite a bit since we added a system to the lighting rig. Anyway, gotta go. Groupies don't just eat themselves, you know?
All well and good. That's the intended consequence. Iggy gets a few more quid to keep the wolf from the door, and the nasty would-be copyright infringers get a flat battery and nothing to show for it. However, it doesn't take more than a few seconds thought to realise there are unintended consequences too. Here's another report. I'm here in the foyer of the Empire Theatre where tonight's opening performance of Turandot was tragically interrupted by an apparently motiveless attack on Belinda Tyne-Smith, well-known socialite. Miss Tyne-Smith was stabbed twice and the attacker, who has not been identified, escaped in the ensuing confusion. A number of witnesses attempted to record the fleeing perpetrator on their phones, but the police say there's little chance of any usable footage due to a LiveGuard system being in use. Miss Tyne-Smith is said to be in a serious but stable condition. Back to the studio. The trouble with this kind of masking technology is that there's always some bycatch, some overlap. From the annoying but harmless, perhaps being unable to record your kids at the park due to a nearby concert, to the serious, like the attack just reported, this kind of indiscriminate blanketing is a blunt instrument at best. One way to get around this would be not to switch the recording off, but to lock it in a way such that the recording could be recovered later with appropriate permissions. The unlocking agency may be the police, the rights holder, or a trusted third party. Existing CCTV installations have this provision already to prevent abuse of the recorded footage. However, that only gets round the problem if you trust the person with the keys to the lock. If they refuse to give you the key, then it's still effectively a shut-off switch. An accidental overspill isn't the only problem. Here's another report from just around the corner.
We've managed to get to the control zone now with a broadcast camera. Apart from tales from refugees, we've not had any citizen reporting from this area since the government clamped down on the water protests last week and deployed high power anti-phantom devices. Pro-government forces have surrounded the town and the local militia have dug in and are fighting back. This is certainly a far cry from the fair control reported by government news channels. So far, we've seen dozens of bodies in the streets, many of them women and children. We're going to have to withdraw now. It's too hot out here. Well, we'll get you another report later if we can.
We've already seen internet blackouts to suppress citizen reporting in the Middle East. We've seen attempts by some sections of the police to confiscate or destroy cell phones. This technology would hand the corrupt and the coercive another tool to add to their arsenal. It's important to recognise censorship where it crops up, especially under an initially friendly guise. With the buzz of largely negative publicity at the moment, the system described in the patent may never be deployed, at least not over here. But after Pete Hegg's report 2 weeks ago on how operating systems are closing up, and the amount of leverage the entertainment industry has, we must beware of how easily technology like this can first be mandated before then being misused. This is Sean Ellis, trying to prevent the future rather than predict it, for the Pod Delusion.
You might remember a few years ago now in Britain, we had the Atheist Bus Campaign. When you think about it, it sort of makes sense, as waiting for a bus is a lot like waiting for God. We all congregate at a place by the side of the road where scripture tells us we should expect a bus, and then it's entirely on faith that we believe a bus will actually turn up. So successful is the idea of an atheist bus, though, that it is spread around the world, and it turns out that in one part of America, they're experiencing a slightly bumpier ride. Here's Salim Fadley with more.
This year's British Humanist Association bus campaign is intended to encourage non-religious people to tick the box marked No Religion in this year's national census. Early versions of the bus ad were rejected by British advertising regulators, apparently on the basis that the strapline, "If you're not religious, for God's sake say so," could be offensive to some religious groups. In the context, it's obvious that this was just a play on words. Unfortunately, the Committee on Advertising Practice feared that this joke might cause widespread and serious offence amongst religious people. Fortunately for the BHA, they had prepared an alternate version of the ad just in case of this sort of thing, and they were able to get their campaign out on time. However, things have been a lot harder for our American friends. In February of this year, a coalition of Arkansas atheist groups raised funds to run some bus adverts. A typical 18-bus ad run would normally cost around $5,000. However, the United Coalition of Reason soon found themselves being charged a vastly inflated fee. I spoke with Bill Burgess, a legal coordinator for the American Humanist Organization, and I began by asking Bill how something as simple as a bus campaign could go so spectacularly wrong.
This went wrong because in the end, I don't think they wanted to run our bus ads at all. And they came up with this requirement for a massive damage deposit as a way to make us go away. They said that they were afraid that local Christians would vandalize the buses or maybe even blow one up.
This ad run would typically cost around $5,000. The Central Arkansas Transport Authority demanded $36,000 in order to run these fairly tame adverts.
That's seven times as much as you were originally quoted. Why on earth would the insurance for something cost seven times more than the thing you're actually trying to insure? That makes no sense at all, unless the Central Arkansas Transit Authority is trying to send you a message.
I think you're exactly right. They were trying to send us a message. They came up with a number, $36,000, that they thought would scare away the local atheist group because they didn't think they could come up with the money. They told us that that's the cost to replace. The ads were going to run on 18 buses, each has two sides. That's $36,000. They said that the cost was $2,000 per side to replace it. If the side of the bus were totally defaced and had to be repainted.
The insurance cost they were billing you to run these ads was the cost of complete replacement of every single unit in their fleet. They were basically anticipating a total loss as a consequence of running your ad. That doesn't sound like normal insurance business practice to me. Is that normal in Arkansas?
I don't know if it's normal in Arkansas, but I know that it's not normal for the transit authority. And they admitted as much. They've never asked anyone else to put up a deposit of any kind.
Perhaps the transit authority have some regulations against advertising which carries a controversial religious message. Have they ever allowed controversial religious advertising before?
They routinely accept advertising from politicians in connection with their campaigns and from local churches. They have no policy excluding ads that are controversial or political or religious.
So I guess you're feeling a bit discriminated against here.
That's exactly how we feel. Their decision was to try to scare us off because they didn't like what we had to say.
But perhaps Move On Advertising did have a point. So Move On Advertising was the agent appointed by Central Arkansas Transit Authority to administer their advertising. Perhaps your advert really was far too controversial or contained something that would be offensive to some Arkansas Christians. After all, these people are not known for their rational behavior. Isn't it probable that a crazy person will take some kind of action that could damage your adverts or the Transport Authority buses?
It's certainly possible, although I think the person responsible for damaging a bus in that situation would be the one who damaged the bus, and not the person who ran an ad that, in the end, wasn't very controversial in my view at all.
Can you give an impression of just how non-controversial this ad was?
Sure, I'll describe it for you. It's a background of blue and white clouds, and the text says, "Are you good without God? Millions are." And then it gives the website address for the local atheist group.
Shock, horror.
Yes, it's not targeted at Christians. It's not trying to convert anybody or offend anybody. It's simply letting the local atheists know that they're not alone.
So reading through your court filings, I understand that even though you felt that being asked to pay an extraordinary deposit was unreasonable, you did offer the Central Arkansas Transit Authority a compromise of a $10,000 refundable deposit, which they rejected.
Yes, that's right. They asked for a deposit. A $10,000 figure was put out there. We agreed to pay it. And then a few days later, they came back and said, "We're declining to run your ads." Obviously, that wasn't good enough for them.
So it seems to me that really the money or the risk of damage had nothing at all to do with their reasons for rejecting your ads.
I agree. I think the reason they rejected our ads is they don't like the content, the speech. They disagree with it. I think they personally found it offensive.
Central Arkansas Transport Authority are not a private company, are they? They're actually a government agency of sorts, and that means they're regulated by the U.S. Constitution, which includes First Amendment protections that specifically prohibit this kind of discrimination. Surely they were aware that this kind of discriminatory behavior was likely to invite a lawsuit.
I don't know how they couldn't be aware. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution prohibits any governmental entity, and in this case we're talking about a public bus company which is owned by the state of Arkansas, from discriminating against speakers and restricting their rights of freedom of speech. If they'd talked to their lawyers first, I think they would have concluded that they don't have a case. They were clearly treating the local atheist group differently than they would have treated a church that wanted to run an ad, letting other local Christians know that a church was out there for them.
This does indeed look like a pretty flagrant violation of your First Amendment rights, combined with a hefty helping of breach of contract and perhaps some deception. But it also fits the pattern which we've seen worldwide, where sneaky attempt to suppress atheist advertising have resulted in the campaigns becoming far more famous than it could ever have been had the authorities simply obeyed the rules. Why do you think this keeps happening?
It's ironic. Obviously, when we sue them because they've refused to let us run an advertisement, every news organization in town and several national news organizations run a story about this, and they interview us, and we get all sorts of free press. And if they were really interested in suppressing our speech, they would just agree to run the ads, and very few people would see them, and that would be that. But they don't seem to have that sense.
It is indeed ironic that religious people are prepared to break the law in order to suppress non-religious speech. Some religious people clearly believe that their faith gives them a right to be shielded from possible offence. This is yet another example of religious groups seeking special privileges simply on the basis of their religion. This is Sal Infadi for The Pod Delusion.
Now, you know that feeling when you park up at a private members club in your Bentley, getting ready to sip on some champagne and snort some cocaine off a prostitute, but then someone on incapacity benefit pulls up in their BMW, lights a cigar on a 50? Annoying, isn't it? As, after all, you've earned the right to be a massive dick, and they didn't. Well, thankfully, the government are cracking down on these freeloaders. Ooh, just because I'm physically unable to work, the state should feel a moral obligation to ensure that I have access to a basic standard of living, they cry. Disabled people get all the luck. However, some people think that I've got a bit of the wrong attitude, so here's Stephen Sumter taking a closer look.
Last Sunday, the Sunday Times ran a front-page story under the headline, State Hands Out BMWs to Disabled. It was factually incorrect in both the headline and in several points made in the article. Although the headline attacked the very concept of people that receive disability benefits daring to own a high-end car, the bulk of the story went on to talk about relatives and carers using the car without the disabled person present. The same story appeared in numerous national and local newspapers. The story in most of the local papers was actually word for word the same. Just Google flash cars leased to disabled people to find many examples of it. I don't think I can put this any more simply. The government does not hand out cars to disabled people. What actually happens is that the most severely affected sick or disabled people can claim disability living allowance, which includes a mobility component. Those people receive money to spend as they choose, perhaps to buy a wheelchair or to go towards taxi fares. Many choose to sign over all of the mobility part of their DLA to the Motability Scheme, a scheme which is not government run, and in return for their money they receive a car, a wheelchair or a scooter. They can also choose to pay an extra fee to upgrade to one of the more expensive cars available through the scheme. In the case of a BMW, that would be at least an extra £1,400 paid up front out of the customer's own pocket. A motability car can be used by another person on behalf of the sick or disabled person without them being present, for example, going shopping for them or perhaps transporting an item across town for them. If a motability car is used by someone else for their own purposes, that is a breach of the rules of the motability scheme and potentially raises issues because the car is exempt from vehicle tax and was not subject to VAT. Such use does not involve benefit fraud, though, since DLA would have been paid to the sick or disabled person whether they had a car or not. Relatives or carers getting a so-called free car and using it for their own purposes are doing so at the expense of the sick or disabled person, not through benefit fraud. These stories about relatives getting free cars and about people receiving BMWs through Motability are worrying because they seem to originate from the government. The Sunday Times article does not mention it, but the story that was duplicated in many local newspapers quotes a Whitehall source, who would seem to be the only reason that this is a story at all. The quotes from this source are anecdotal in nature, with lines such as, "My neighbours have got this car and it's for their granny, but they ride in it." And the emphasis seems to be heavily weighted towards attacking the motability scheme and smearing the reputation of those that use it. This is not the first time that anonymous government sources have provided stories to newspapers sympathetic to government policies, and only newspapers sympathetic to government policies. In a previous attack, government ministers released a select list of the most outrageous excuses for benefit fraud. Of course, the excuses were bizarre, and most of these cases really were fraud, but no mention was made of the incredibly low rate of benefit fraud, below 1%, and how few cases such excuses represent. The papers also took the opportunity to belittle addiction and bad backs as disabilities, despite them often being crippling and life-destroying. The commonly quoted back pain, for example, can cover many problems, such as degenerative spine conditions, botched surgery causing nerve damage, and curved spine. At the start of the month, another attack aimed at the rise in numbers claiming DLA and again belittling back pain, as well as mental health and addiction, several mainstream newspapers quoted a source close to the reforms. We are not told who exactly this information came from, and yet it appeared in several newspapers at the same time. I have been unable to find a press release that correlates to this information, and so I must assume that these figures have been leaked to preferred newspapers by someone in government. Then we have government ministers giving out inaccurate or just plain wrong statistics. Last month, Minister for the Disabled, Maria Miller, announced on live television news that more people receive benefits for drug and alcohol addiction than for blindness. Actually, official figures show that 69,000 people receiving benefits list blindness as their primary condition, against 22,800 who list alcohol and drug addiction. Apart from the error, this is an example of a government minister distinguishing the deserving from the undeserving, something that David Cameron seems anxious to deny, even while perpetuating the idea. Earlier this year, Employment Minister Chris Grayling stated to the press that 75% of people claiming employment and support allowance were found fit to work. However, that included 39% who withdrew their claim before it was complete for reasons unknown, and 16% who were placed in the work-related activity group to receive support towards eventually going back to work. Still, the Daily Mail enjoyed it. Ian Duncan Smith recently stated during an interview on Newsnight that people on benefits are putting nothing back into the community, which, if not an attack, at least shows a disturbing lack of knowledge about how such people live. Certainly, in all the places that I have lived in, many not in paid employment have put the most back into their communities through volunteering and caring. Even the opposition seems to be getting in on the act, with Ed Miliband talking about going after the take-what-you-can culture and branding benefit claimants as lazy shirkers and cheats. Presumably, this is seen as the best way to attract votes and popularity these days. A visitor to my blog suggested an explanation to the mysterious sources quoted in so many newspaper stories recently. He said, "A Whitehall source normally means Departmental Special Advisers, or SPADs, party hacks who are paid out of public funds to work as political advisers in government departments. As a relatively senior ex-civil servant, I have no doubt that this campaign is being orchestrated by a combination of SPADs and Conservative Central Office, with the tacit approval of ministers. I've seen it before, although not a campaign as nasty and squalid as this." This explanation does seem plausible, although I am not sure how anyone would go about proving it. Wherever they come from, these attacks add up to something very disturbing. The government is rushing through welfare reform with only an occasional speed bump when people raise specific issues, such as cancer patients that won't have enough time to recover if their ESA is limited to just 1 year. It is worth noting that when Ed Miliband highlighted these 7,000 cancer patients, he didn't mention the other 700,000 seriously sick or disabled people that will be affected by the same time limit rules. The pace of savage cuts and reforms justified by rhetoric and propaganda is terrifying and seems to be taking us towards a society that no longer cares for those who are sick or disabled. This is Stephen Sumter for The Pod Delusion.
Now, a few weeks ago, a terminally ill teenager's final bucket list caught the Twitterati's imagination. Unfortunately, though, as Twitter is quite insular, rather than actually helping fulfil the teenager's wish of everyone being on the bone marrow register, they instead gave her the gift of trending on Twitter, which is a bit crap. So, to try and make up for this, Keir Little has been finding out more about bone marrow donation.
Alice is 15, and she has terminal cancer. Alice has also started a blog for her bucket list, which is a list of things she wants to do before she dies. Unfortunately, some of these she'll be unable to do. But there is one thing that she might be able to do, and that is to encourage everyone to sign up to be a bone marrow donor. I spoke to Rebecca Sedgwick, National Recruitment Manager for the Anti Nolan Trust, to ask her just how important it is to sign up to donate bone marrow.
A lot of people wonder why we need them, because we do say it's quite rare that you're actually chosen to donate. But we have to match people on tissue types, and as there are literally hundreds of millions of different tissue types in this world, when someone needs a transplant, it's a bit like looking for a needle in a haystack to find that match. So the more people we have on the register, the more tissue types we have access to, so the more people we'll be able to provide transplants for.
Are there any particular groups that you'd really like to encourage to sign up to donate? Are there any groups, you know, age, gender, ethnicity that you really need on the register?
Yes, we really do need men aged 18 to 30 to join the register. They're very underrepresented on our register, but the truth is the matter, they're most likely to be chosen to donate. So at the moment, about 80% of the people that donate for us are males every year, but they only make up about 19% of the register aged 18 to 30. So if we can increase that number, we will have a dramatic effect on the number of bone marrow transplants we can offer.
Is there anything particular about this group, young men, you know, aged 18 to 30, that you want to encourage to sign up the register? Is there anything special about this group, or is it just that there aren't that many of them that have signed up?
Men can donate more stem cells in one go, so they're preferred by the transplant centres. And also, males in this age range generally have a lot less health conditions that affect them donating.
One of the major obstacles that most people quote to me when they talk about donating or registering to donate is that they're afraid that it's really going to hurt, because there's this idea that the procedure is really invasive and it's really, really painful and there's quite a long recovery time involved. How true is any of that?
It's completely untrue, and it's a message we try and get across all the time. There is a method which we call stem cell harvest, which does involve an operation with a general anaesthetic, and we take the cells we need from your pelvic bone. That way can leave you with some general back discomfort for about a week afterwards. That's only done in 20% of cases now. For 80% of people that donate every year, they donate via the bloodstream. So you have an injection once a day for 3 days. That makes your body produce a lot more of the stem cells we need, and your body stores them in your bloodstream. And we can get them by basically hooking you up to very similar to a platelet donation machine. You have a lining in one arm which takes the blood out of your body. It passes through the machine where we get the cells we need, and we pop your blood back in your other arm.
How long does it generally take, this procedure?
It's very straightforward. It takes about 4 hours of your time.
There are a couple of exclusions applied to donation criteria. I don't want to talk too many about them, but if I could just ask you what some of the rationale is by excluding some people who have mental health issues.
Well, with the mental health issues, because when a patient needs a transplant, we need to make sure that the available donor is committed to going through with the procedure at that point in time, as the patient is in a very critical condition. And we do exempt people with more serious mental health conditions from joining, because we need to protect their health at the time of donating as much as the doctor needs to protect the patient's health. We need to make sure that they are fully committed and able to go through with the donation.
So obviously there are these people who are excluded for various medical reasons, some for mental health, some for other underlying conditions. What sort of things can people who find themselves excluded, what can they do to help the trust? How can they help if they can't donate physically their own bone marrow?
Yes, I would ask first that everybody check with us whether they are actually excluded, because we do have a lot of different criteria to the blood service, which people often compare us to. And a lot of people that cannot donate blood can actually join the bone marrow register. So on an individual basis, I'd ask each person to either go on our website or give us a ring, and we can say on their personal case whether they would be able to join or not. But also, we are a charity and we always need fundraisers. We also do need people to spread the word. You might not be able to join yourself, but you can tell 10 of your friends about us.
So what can anyone do who's listening to this, who wants to donate or wants to volunteer to fundraise or help the trust?
they go to our website, which is www.antinolan.org, and just click on Join Online. It'll take you through our online application form, and at the end it'll say whether you are eligible to join or not. And if you are, you'll get a saliva kit sent in the post within about 3 to 5 days. And you simply give us a saliva sample, all the instructions are included in there, and there's a prepaid envelope to send it back to us.
So there you go. Donating bone marrow needn't be a torturous chore. In fact, you know, it's likely you won't even be called on, as Rebecca says, but they do need people. They do need to find matches. So I'd like to encourage all of you listening to this to look at the facts, to look at the situation, and please, please do consider donating your bone marrow. Thank you.
Finally this week, Drew Ray has been taking part in an intriguing new project to try and make the kids interested in science. Called I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here, it would seem that a bunch of scientists are competing to be the best science communicator. Presumably, it's all going to be presented by Rad and Deck. Here's Drew Ray with more.
With the focus on rising education fees and private institutions, it's easy to lose sight of the human side of academia. I've been taking part in an event in the past 2 weeks that aims to show some of that human side to students. Rather than telling you about it myself, I thought it appropriate to interview one of the participants. Dr. Tom Crick is a lecturer in computing in Cardiff, as well as a 2011 British Science Association Media Fellow working with BBC Wales. I began by asking Tom about his work as a scientist.
In my research area, the hardware-software interface, I suppose, looking at next-generation microprocessor technologies, efficiency of embedded devices, compiler optimizations, and high-performance computing. And so my teaching roles are kind of related to that, so programming and mathematical foundations. And also I'm in charge of our undergraduate admissions. There's a mix between strong technical, traditional computer science students, and we also have a few applied socio-technical courses, business information systems.
Tom sees his role as a scientist as broader than just teaching in a lecture theatre.
Increasingly over the past 2 to 3 years, primarily as a way of changing the perception of computing and computer science. I think it sometimes gets a bit short shrift with regards to the other mainstream sciences. I think some people tend to think computer science is just about using computers or, you know, IT. So wider stuff working with the British Science Association. I've got one of the 2011 British Science Association Media Fellowships, and I'm going to be working with BBC Wales. So policies for widening participation and engaging with science subjects.
For the past fortnight, Tom and I have been taking part in an event called I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here. The event is funded by the Wellcome Trust and produced by Gullah Manor Communications Limited. The event aims to improve student understanding of and engagement with science teaching by allowing them to interact directly with real working scientists.
It sounds an interesting name, but it's an award-winning science enrichment and engagement activity. It's funded by the Wellcome Trust. Pairs up scientists and students from across the UK from a wide range of schools, make it sort of a friendly and easy engagement process. So you chat to a classroom of kids and they basically pepper you with questions. And it's an intensive 30-minute chat where in each zone there's 4 or 5 scientists and you get an absolute deluge of questions. And then also you have kind of a number of offline questions. Students are free over the 2 weeks to ask you any question. And I think I've answered about 450 so far. There have been some very interesting questions. They've ranged from across the main scientists, quite classic questions of explain the Big Bang, you know, how's the universe going to end? Even some kind of very, you know, some real nice questions, you know, explain wave-particle duality. Also kind of more personal questions about explaining our research or kind of what do we do as a day job. And then, you know, real kind of tough questions kind of justifying our research. So saying, you know, why is your research important and how does it actually benefit society? And then there are some genuine, quite random questions of what sort of music do you like? What's your favourite football team? What car do you drive? How much do you earn? Very random things like, you know, why are Jamaicans faster at running than British people? Or who invented houses? Do you like fingers or toes? There are some very random questions, but generally there are, you know, they are kind of spread across the sciences. It's a real popular initiative. I think it's good to, maybe this mode of interaction is a real informal way of actually getting people to think about science and also to engage with actual kind of practicing scientists and researchers. It's an easy way of doing it because it's an online chat, is less formal, there's less pressure, and instead of going into the classroom and making people stick their hand up and ask questions, feel less pressure and will ask more directed questions. I think it's generally a positive thing. And I mean, popularity wise, I think it's been going for a couple of years now, and every time it's run, it has gone kind of much more popular. There's scientists desperate to get involved. The number of schools involved is increased every time. The traffic to the site is huge. And following the hashtag on Twitter, which is, you know, IAS 2011, you know, there's loads of traffic on there. It's kind of, people are really taking notice of this, and it's a, kind of a significant science communication event now.
Dr. Tom Quick, good luck, and thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
For the sake of brevity, I've left out Tom's thoughts about what he would do with the £5,000 if he wins the event. But you can find out about this and see all the questions Tom has answered in the cadmium zone of imascientist.org.uk. This is Drew Ray, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
And that's almost it for this week's show, but first, a brief appeal. If you like the Pod Delusion, enjoy what we do, enjoy programmes like this and all the extra stuff on our extra feed, then why not consider supporting the Pod Delusion with money? I'd really like you to support the Pod Delusion with money. Why not sign up to a subscription to the Pod Delusion on the Pod Delusion website? Don't worry, the podcast is entirely free to download, but it'd be really cool, if you really do enjoy the show, to sign up and say pledge, say, £5 or £10 a month to us so we can keep doing what we do. Or if a subscription's not really a thing, you can also make one-off donations too. I realise it's a bit crass to ask for money, but I've been doing this so long and promoting this so much, I've got very little shame left. Also on our website, of course, you can listen back to older episodes of the Pod Delusion, and do check out our extra feed where this week we'll be uploading more and more recordings from the British Humanist Association annual conference held in Manchester. There'll be all sorts of exciting stuff going up in the next week, including spots by Natalie Haynes, Polly Toynbee, Peter Atkins, Chris French, all these sort of names, and it's all fascinating stuff. So do check it out there at poddelusion.co.uk. Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Liz Luckendorf, Sean Ellis, Salim Fadley, Stephen Sumter, Keir Liddle, Drew Ray, and me, James O'Malley. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. In a moment, you'll be hearing a brief snippet by David Lovesey. Thanks for listening.
Good evening and welcome to the Global Village. I'm Jeremy Manpax, and tonight I'm joined by John Mallard, a former programme advisor for the World Service and the BBC.
Good evening.
Mr. Mallard, John, I know you think we've asked you along tonight to talk about budget cuts within the BBC. I'm afraid that's not quite true.
Oh, right.
No, what I'd like to talk to you about is the deplorable situation that's just come to light in Burma.
Right.
How can you justify it?
I think you're talking to the wrong man, Mr. Manpax. I just work for the BBC. The Burmese government and their regime of oppression is not to be lauded, but...
I'm not talking about that, Mr. Mallard. I'm, of course, referring to the breaking news that the pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi has finally been released from house arrest after 15 years.
Great news, but what does it have to do with me?
15 years, Mr. Mallard, where she has been forced, through your programming input, to listen to Dave Lee Travis on the World Service.
Pardon?
Oh, come on, don't pretend you didn't know.
Well,
Did you or did you not have a hand in Dave Lee Travis broadcasting to the world? The hairy cornball.
The hairy cornflake.
You sound like quite the expert, Mr. Mallard. Why? Why Dave Lee whack whack oops Travis? Are you some kind of sadist?
Well, it wasn't just me. I mean, there was...
I see. Just following orders, were you?
Well, yes, but I...
Look, mate, that didn't work in Nuremberg and it won't work here.
Now, hang on. She listened to DLT of her own free will. And we've, we've redressed the balance since...
Have you? And what have you done to atone for your crimes against humanity, Mr. Mallard?
Well, since we've learned that the Burmese generals are listening, we've started transmitting non-stop Chris Moyles. On a loop.
I see. Well, you vicious bastard. John Mallard, thank you very much.
Good night.